This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. I am very happy to have with me today Mary Mackey, M-A-C-K-E-Y. She is celebrating her seventh collection of poetry, published recently by Marsh Hawk Press, and the name of the book is Travelers with No Ticket Home. Mary read at the Word Temple Poetry Series, some of you were there, when her most recent book, Sugar Zone, came out from Marsh Hawk, and that book won the 2012 Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Award. She's also the author of 13 novels, and she has traveled Brazil for the past 20 years plus, I guess, by now. And like Sugar Zone, the poems in her new book take place for the large part in Brazil. So welcome back to the States, Mary. How are you?
Thank you. I'm fine and very happy to be here.
So how is it that you've come to spend so much time in Brazil?
Well, I've always had a love of Latin America. I lived off and on in the rainforest of Costa Rica for about 6 years when I was in my 20s. And I love tropical jungles and rainforest, you know, which we now call rainforests. We used to call them jungles, but rainforest sounds so much more benevolent. And I've been into the Amazon several times. And now with my present husband, who is a Brazilian environmentalist and historian, I've traveled with him on his research trips into Brazil. And we've also gone into the Amazon, taken trips up the Amazon several times, and lived in Rio de Janeiro. So we've been every year for actually about the last 25 years.
Wow. So you must know it well. What kind of changes have you seen over 25 years?
Interestingly enough, one of the biggest changes I've seen is climate change. Yeah. It has become, the tropics have a very small margin between comfort and extremely uncomfortable. And in Rio, certainly last January, birds were literally, I'm not making this up, falling out of the sky from the heat. There was a heat index of 122 last January, which is their summer. And, you know, people were rushing the birds to shade and putting cool water on them. And this is unprecedented, has been unprecedented heat, and it's scary.
It's very scary. Yeah. Not that there's any such thing as global warming. As you did in Sugar Zone, the poems that take place in Brazil, you incorporate Portuguese in a lot of your poems along with the English, and you've done that again in your new book. I wonder if you would just start out by reading the opening poem of Travelers with No Ticket Home.
Okay. And I should say that you're never too old to learn a language, because I taught myself Portuguese when I was in my mid-40s.
And,
and I've been working on it. I work on it a lot. The opening poem, let me say just before I read this, that I've made sure all these poems are perfectly comprehensible in English. So if you don't speak English, the poems are, I mean, don't speak any language but English, the poems are completely English friendly.
Absolutely.
If you speak other languages, particularly Latinate languages like Spanish or French, even Romanian, you'll get something else. And if you speak Portuguese, of course, you get another layer.
Right,
in English,
right.
It just becomes like an ohm in the background. The first poem in Travelers with No Ticket Home is called Jacob's Ladder. And that's a reference, of course, to the ladder in the Bible where Jacob sees angels climbing up and down a ladder between earth and heaven. And it's also a quilt pattern that I have a quilt my Kentucky aunts made for me that was a Jacob's Ladder quilt. Jacob's Ladder. My great aunts, hair done up in braids, calico feed sack dresses, aprons full of chicken feed, knew absolute silence, breath of a candle, hiss of a coal oil lamp, the cackle of a laying hen. But what would they have said if I'd spoke to them in Portuguese? Queridas tias, dearest aunts, the jungle is thicker than corn, mais grosso do que o milho, greener than cucumbers, mais verde do que pepinos, filled with black lagoons that shine like obsidian. Queridas tias, dearest aunts, sooner or later, mais cedo ou mais tarde, we all stand at the foot of a ladder that's missing rungs, speaking in tongues no one can understand.
Hmm. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I really like that you use the Portuguese in the poem because it kind of helps us hear Brazil more. Right?
Yeah, and it's a beautiful musical language. I'm totally in love with Portuguese.
Yeah, it is nice. You told me recently about a tree. I didn't know it was a tree at the time, but I saw the title of one of your poems, Crown of Parrots. And it is such a beautiful name. And these images come to mind of, you know, this tree just made of parrots. So why don't you go ahead and read Crown of Parrots, and if there's something you want to tell us about the tree, please
sure.
do.
Crown of Parrots is common name of the tree. That's the common name of the tree, and it's one of the trees that's threatened by logging. It's a hardwood tree, and it's one of the great Amazonian rainforest trees. The Amazon has more diversity of trees than anywhere in the world.
Still,
there's a lot of it. The good news is a lot of it that's not been logged.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the words that are in this poem in Portuguese, except for the last word, igarapé, which means stream, almost all these words, the longer words, are the names, the common Indian or Portuguese names of endangered trees that are being logged mm-hmm. and sent off for lumber down the river. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my great concerns, is the logging of the Amazon. Crown of Parrots. Among the pale columns of light that fall from the great trees, wild pigs are swimming the river like commuters entering a phantom city. Your breath smells of pinga, your lips are the color of acai. The forest floor beneath our feet seethes with iridescent flies that rise up around us in clouds like hissing stars. You are calling up the dead again, the lost ones who leave holes at our tables, chanting in that high, terrifying voice you always used when you spoke to your mother. Seru, Garandi Kanduru, you're crying. There will be no escape. Palma Fing, Angeling Vermilho, Crown of Parrots. Solange, what horrors are you courting as we stand knee-deep in flies, trapped between this black water river and this muddy igarapé?
Tell me about Solange.
Solange walked into my previous book of poems, Sugar Zone, without me anticipating her, and she stayed. And she's either a priestess, a shaman, a wilder aspect of Mary Mackey, an ex-lover. I'm not telling. You know, I have Solange contains all ambiguity. Sometimes she's a goddess. Often you find her in defense of the environment and mm-hmm. the rainforest. And she moves through these poems as a recurring spirit, really, a muse.
Mm-hmm. She's a very nice presence in your books.
Yeah, but she's not always a sweet person because she's fiercely defensive, but she's a very powerful, benevolent female presence.
How did you come up with the name Solange?
I was reading a book in Portuguese called The Smile of the Lizard, and that was the name of the woman in the book, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized when I looked it up that it was the name of George Sand's daughter, one of her daughters.
Really?
Yes, and I thought, that's the name for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, good. You have a poem called In Those Days Rivers Could Not Cool Me.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the I in this poem who cooked monkey and cream sauce?
That is one of the few totally autobiographical poems in this book. I was living in a small field, remote field station in Costa Rica, the only woman with a bunch of male biologists. And I, of course, at that era was doing all the cooking, and they would bring me things to cook. And one day, to my absolute horror, they bought me a monkey. And I said, I'm not cooking this unless you clean it so it doesn't look like a monkey. And then I had one package of dried cream sauce in the Fanny Farmer cookbook. So instead of making Hassenpfeffer, which was the only recipe, I made Munkenpfeffer.
Oh, no. Wow. Well, I want you to read the poem, but, you know, I'm going to have to ask you how you ended up on this trip with all of these male biologists.
My husband of the decade was a tropical biologist, first husband.
Okay.
So I ended up, I ended up going down to live in remote places in at that time, parts of Costa Rica that there were no roads into the jungle.
Now, you graduated from Harvard University.
Yeah, I did.
Did all this take place after you graduated?
Yeah, I went down there when I was very young. I graduated mm-hmm. fairly young, and it happened, right after I graduated, first time I went down.
Okay, well, go ahead and read the poem.
Okay. In those days, rivers could not cool me. I once lived in places where volcanoes erupted, the water was poison, and the night swarmed with termites that tasted like glue. There were rooms where I lay so wrapped in fever that the fans overhead seemed ecstatic in their whirling. Rooms where I saw light the color of blood and bruised plums, had hallucinations, dreams, terrors so great they set me shrieking. Once, for 4 hours straight, I spoke in rhymed couplets, and no one could make me shut up, until I threw off the sheets and ran into the tropical night like a woman on fire. In those days, rivers could not cool me, threats could not subdue me. I burned and burned with illness, lust, and fear, and your lightest touch seemed like a blow. Later, I cooked a monkey in cream sauce, and we ate it as jungle rats ran the rafters over our heads. The next afternoon, I nearly stepped on a 9-foot fer de lance. Only a madwoman could have loved such a life. But I did. I do. Love the strangeness of it, the non-humanness of it, the sure knowledge that death was so small and close it could buzz in my ear.
Mm, wow. I have to ask what it's like for you after spending time in, you know, the rainforest in Costa Rica and Brazil. You know, you take these trips and then you come back, you live in Berkeley. What kind of culture shock do you go through?
Well, some of it's great. Like, you can drink water out of the faucet.
Yeah,
you don't have to worry about dengue and malaria and typhoid and all sorts of tropical things, or even mosquitoes in Berkeley. Uh-huh. And so in many ways, and then it's easy in some ways. In other ways, if you come back from a long time, it's very shocking. Our society is so speedy. I often can't drive for a week after I come back. I just can't look at the traffic. And sometimes I can't go in big stores because of the advertising. It's like everything is screaming at you. You've been in this very quiet place. And I think the thing that once got me the most when I lived 5 months out of the country in the tropics was that I came back into, and I've been around starving people, you know, people who were trying to get land and defending their land. And it was very difficult situation for them. And I came back in a grocery store and there was a whole shelf of food that had no calories. And I looked at it and I had a small personal nervous breakdown and walked out of the store. You know, you get over it though, you readjust. But it is always a shock. It's quite a shock.
Yeah. I mean, no matter where you go, like you mentioned the grocery store.
Yeah.
They're trying to get your attention.
Yeah.
Attention.
Advertising,
you know,
advertising.
Yeah.
Now, if you live in Rio de Janeiro, the Brazilians are a lot like us. They're, you know, they're very speedy people. They have a lot of advertising then. So it's not as big a shock to come back from Rio to here.
Right. From a city to a city. Well, reading through your book, you know, I'm really enjoying all of these poems that have a very strong Brazilian influence. But then I ran into some poems that have a rather Japanese sensibility, and it's this section called the Kama Sutra of Kindness. They are really beautiful poems. Where did these come from? And of course, I'd like you to read maybe two of them.
These poems, the Kama Sutra of Kindness, I started writing in 1975.
Oh,
and
my.
I've written, there are only six, actually seven Kama Sutra of Kindness poems now, six with that title. And I've written them since then, you know, over a period of more than 30 years. They just come to me one by one as very clear, very specific visions. They're like visionary love poems. Mm-hmm. And they're just, you know, just sort of the lyrical essence to me of the feeling of love and tenderness and, you know, kind of rapture. Mm-hmm. And the Kama Sutra, of course, is about the positions of sex. And I thought we needed one of kindness.
Because
those two go together for me, you know. So, would you like me to read?
Please read a couple from that
section.
Okay,
you want the
They're
short
really
ones?
Beautiful.
I have a long one or some short ones.
Whatever you want to read.
Okay. In the flame of a single candle, entire cities are appearing and disappearing. My hands tremble on you. My fingers pass through you. Your tongue tastes like apples. Your flesh is fog. Above our roof, the jealous moon has torn a hole in the sky. The Kama Sutra of Kindness, position number 4. You claim you long for me the way a drowning man longs to breathe. Poised above me, tortured as a saint, you pause, then descend, speaking with a tongue that tastes of honey and salt. Reason be damned. Look, even the light around us has changed. And I'll read one more short one.
Good.
The Kama Sutra of Kindness, position number 6. A river of molten glass paved with fine white sand, and on the far bank, A thousand trees eternally burning, eternally throwing themselves into the sky. Look, where two blue-winged macaws frozen in mid-flight over a wall of green fire. Strangers lost in the jungle of each other's bodies. Lovers who don't want to be found.
This is beautiful, really beautiful.
Thank you.
Mary, where are you from? Tell us a
little bit. I'm originally from Indianapolis, Indiana. Oh. Although I spent my summers on a small farm in western Kentucky on the Ohio River. So I'm kind of bilingual in Yankee and Southern.
Yankee, Southern, Portuguese, you name it.
Well, yeah, I mean, and my doctorate's in comparative literature. So languages, and I've always been fascinated with language, and I've learned a number of languages, and I love language and words. So.
Yeah, well, your poetry is just so stunning.
Thank you.
I don't usually ask people, you know, who their influences are, but I'm going to ask you that.
Well, St. John of the Cross, William Blake, Pablo Neruda, Emily Dickinson, mystical poets, poets of quick motion and concise composition.
Yes.
Definitely lyrical poetry. Certainly the romantic poets, Keats, Byron.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are the ones that formed me when I was younger. I, of course, come across many fabulous poets later who have written, but these were the essential ones.
The foundation.
And you know, it's this kind of visionary look at other worlds that while keeping your feet in this one. It's the the world behind the world that's very important. Mirabai,
nice.
Kabir. These are all influences on my work.
Fabulous. Well, I'm going to shift gears because you have a poem in here that I just couldn't believe the title. The Martyrdom of Carmen Miranda.
Yes.
And I learned things about Carmen Miranda that I didn't know because of your poem. Where did this one come from?
When we were living in Rio de Janeiro in 2012, we lived there for 4 months in a tiny little apartment overlooking the bay. And not far from us, a walking distance, was the Carmen Miranda Museum, which you should check out if you're in Rio. It's a very small museum, but it changed my whole image of Carmen Miranda, when I first saw Carmen Miranda, first of all, I thought she was speaking in Spanish. I didn't realize she was singing in Portuguese before I knew Spanish. And I always thought of her as this sort of happy, bouncy, kind of silly person. And when I found out about her life, as you'll see from the poem, it's very different.
Very different, indeed.
The Martyrdom of Carmen Miranda. And it has an epigraph. If you want to look like the quintessential hoochie-coochie girl, there's no better costume to have than the Ultimate Collection Carmen Miranda outfit. Vubies Costume Company advertisement. In that foreign land, you were always a joke. The fruit basket hats, the crippling high heels, the bare midriff, the broken English, the carnival mask smile. Dumbing up in pom-poms like a pet poodle, wearing your past on the inside like a hair shirt. The Brazilian bombshell who could only say, "Hot dog, mani, mani, does you like me?" Never mentioning the long hours you worked in the hat shop to buy medicine for your tubercular sister, the bad marriage to the man who beat you, the miscarriages, depression, pills, the pain you felt when at last you came home and discovered your own people despised you for selling out to Uncle Sam. When your gay composer protested your betrayal of Brazil by swallowing rat poison, you danced on like a frantic puppet, singing of the Afro-Brazilian gods in a language no one understood. Chicka-chicka-boom-chick, chicka-chicka-boom-chick. Carmen, like you, we're all travelers who set out believing we can bring back something to make it worth the trip. Money, love, hammocks, fame, something that will make us happy and whole, something that will heal our wounds and give us peace.
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, what is the image of Carmen Miranda? It's her with, you know, her outfit on,
and
her
being very silly and making mistakes in English all that.
You know, another dumb broad.
Yeah, right? Exactly. That's what I see. I see that as her martyrdom, you know.
So her, the man who committed suicide.
He was her composer who wrote her songs. And I'm sorry, I am spacing it on his name.
Yeah, that's okay. I would remember or know it anyway. But he's felt that she sold out.
Yeah, she in the movies and in the kinds mm-hmm. of thing, in the way she was portraying Brazilian culture, and she wasn't singing mm-hmm. the political songs that she had been singing that he was writing, and the and oh. you know, and he felt she had betrayed Brazil and betrayed him, and he sat down to park and drank rat poison.
What a way to go. I mean, my
yeah,
God.
Yeah, how horrible.
Horrific.
Truly.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, and I would like to just turn the mic over to you and choose, a few more poems to read for us.
Okay. Well, let's see here. How about The People of Brazil Discover the Portuguese?
Lovely.
The People of Brazil Discover the Portuguese. Easter, April 1st. 1500. Vast blue bleeding into a gray horizon, surf choking on the rocks, something's broken through the storm clouds that line up in the afternoon like bundles of piaçava. For thousands of years we've had our canoes, our fishing nets circling in the air, the taste of mangoes in our mouths, the rocking of our hammocks, the scent of jacaranda. What is it that comes out of the east like a tower of bones, white with fluttering wings, larger than the largest bird we've ever seen? What new plague is the wind blowing toward us?
And I know I just said choose some poems of your own, but
yeah.
there is one more.
Okay, I'm happy to read whatever you like.
You have a listener's request.
Okay.
It's Solange Taunts the Colonels of Pará.
I love that poem.
It's a transformation.
Can you tell me what
poem.
Page it is?
It is on page 43.
Okay. Solange Taunts. Now, I should tell you who the colonels are. Large parts of Brazil are owned by huge landowners who are called colonels, like Kentucky colonels. You know, mm-hmm. they're not real. And they have huge armies, private armies of men called jagunços, which means hitman in Brazilian Portuguese. And there are actually 25 words for hitman in Brazilian Portuguese that gives you an idea
of
how it leads. So this is Solange taunts the colonels of Pará. And Pará is one of the logged off parts of the Amazon. Solange taunts the colonels of Pará. She lifts the flowers to her lips and blows on them until the petals flap like the wings of egrets. She disappears, becomes invisible, incorporeal, immaterial, delusional, transforms herself into a snake, stalks us like a jaguar, tears at our throats, and heals us with a kiss. When the colonels and their jagunços come to kill her, she greets them by pulling up her skirt. Which of you fat men with big guns and small pistolas is brave enough to enter the door that leads to nowhere, she cries. Which of you wants to die with the taste of cashews on his tongue? After they run away, she sleeps for 40 days. When she wakes, she tells us to place another row of small black seeds on her tongue, calls them the bitter stones that pave the path to paradise.
Oh, that's great. Okay, so now we have... Oh, we still have some time. Go ahead.
I'll read one
Your
more.
Your turn.
There's a big dam that's going to destroy a huge part of the Amazon called the Belo Monte Dam. It's on the Xingu River, and it's 20 years there's been a fight for that. People, the indigenous people, have died to keep this dam from being built, and it keeps being threatened to be built. And this is called Solange Encourages a River to Destroy a Dam. Xingu, Xingu, who is that dancer whirling and blind? Xingu, what god rides her head? Xingu, you're a jagunço, a jacaraca, a santa mulher, a holy woman who smokes a cigar. You're the boca da cobra, the mouth of the snake, the soft pink part we see just before it strikes.
Mm. Is that a done deal, or are they still...
They're still fighting it, yeah.
They
approve parts of it, and then it gets argued in the legislature, and then people demonstrate and get shot and various uh-huh. things, and it keeps going. So the Belo Monte Dam is still a very... on the Xingu River, which is one of the major tributaries of the Amazon, is still, you know,
yeah,
still up there.
See, this is what I love about your work. I mean, it's so finely crafted. It's absolutely beautiful poetry. And with every page you turn, you learn something new. Mm. It's really remarkable.
Thank you. That's very much my aim.
Yeah, well, you do good. So, the book is called Travelers with No Ticket Home, Poems by Mary Mackey. And it is published by Marsh Hawk Press. And you can go to marshhawkpress.org, and you can probably find it other places,
yeah,
too.
It's distributed everywhere books are distributed.
Speaking of Amazon.
Oh, yeah, we will. Or Small Press Distribution in Berkeley.
There we go.
They're my main distributor for this.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming, Mary.
Thank you very much for having me, Catherine.
You can also go to Mary's personal website, marymackey.com, to find out all kinds of things about what she's doing with novels and a blog she runs and her poetry, marymackey.com. Okay, we have another poet coming up, Lisa Gleskin Stone Street. But first, I'm in the mood for a little Michael McClure. So here he is with the late Ray Manzarek, Spank Me With a Rose.
Spank me with a rose. I'm headed for jail. Just headed for jail. See the little sparrow with her eyes on the hawk. Everything around, it's just more talk. Don't use a knife to pound in a nail. Spank me with a rose. I'm headed for jail. Hawkie's hungry. Sparrow tastes good. Feathers fall down by the side of the road. It's a long way back to where stars lie in bed. Spank me with a rose. Hawkie's hungry and sparrow tastes good. Spank me with a rose. It's a long way back to where a star is lying bare. I'm headed for jail. Don't use a knife. Pound in a nail. Put my hands in deep mud. Get the taste of the floor. Get the taste of the floor. When I look into the night, feet walk out the door. I'm always hungry. The look in your eyes. When I look into the night, your bare feet out the door. Rivers of pearls, barrels of snow. Rivers of tears, barrels of snow. Put my hands in deep mud. Get the taste of the floor. Spank me with a rose. Headed for jail. Long way back to where stars lie in bed. Spank me with a rose. Hawkie's hungry and sparrow tastes good. Don't use a knife. Pound in a nail. Spank me with a rose. I'm headed for jail. Don't use a knife to pound in a nail. Thank you.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My next guest is Lisa Gluskin Stone Street. And did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay, good. Lisa, Gluskin, and then Stone Street. She has a new collection of poems out called Greenhouse that was published by Bull City Press in North Carolina, I believe. Mm-hmm. It actually is coming out in September of 2014. I was lucky to get an early copy of the book. It is the winner of the 2014 Frost Place competition. Her previous book of poems, Tulips, Water, Ash, is also a prize winner. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you.
Good to see you. So remind me of the prize that your first book of poems won.
That was the Morse Prize, and I always joke that I killed it. It was actually the last year that they offered it, because after the...
Oh, no!
Yeah, after the 2008 financial crash, the University Press of New England couldn't keep offering the prize in the series, which was really too bad, because it had been around for 26 years.
Oh, that is a shame.
Yeah, but they published some great books in the interim. So.
I'm familiar with that press because they published the Book of Forms, a book of, what is it called? The Book of Forms, a handbook of poetics that Lewis Putnam Turco edits. And I had a poem in their last version of that book. So it's a very good press, and I'm sorry that prize had to go away. Too bad. Well, we have another prize winner here in your new book, Greenhouse.
It's The Greenhouse.
Excuse me.
It's all right. It's a very tiny "the" on the cover.
It is very tiny, and it's in the dark shade of the cover, The Greenhouse.
Thank you.
We want to get that right. Tell me a little bit about Bull City Press, because their name has come up a couple of times with me recently.
Oh, they're great. It's a micro press out of Durham, North Carolina, and Ross White is the founder and editor, and he just has a great sense for poetry. They publish a couple of books a year at this point. And they're really small, but they do really good work, and they're starting to get noticed. So I was really, really excited to hear that they'd be publishing this book.
Excellent. Let's start off with the opening poem, just to introduce the listeners to this book. It's called Like That. It's a very intimate type of love poem with just the kind of the right dash of panic in it, written by a mother to her new baby. I think it's a really good entry to the book.
All right, should I read it now?
Sure.
Like that. The first time I leaned over and swept the tip of my smallest fingernail down into the whorl of your ear, bigger than your elbow, and you yelped in violation. Forgive me. It is no longer my ear, little boat, little shell I carved. Flushing pink even now at the embarrassment, the satisfaction. Sliver moon of yellow wax, tiny victory. Lovers say, I did not know where my body ended and yours began. I did not know. Even yesterday when you laughed, reared back, your head quick snap against my upper lip, both of us laughing and then me still laughing, eye sting, drop of blood at the crown of your head, panic. Oh, mine. This morning, holding, rough, soft, drawing my tongue up under my lip, compelling, like that. And entirely unlike, of course. Of course we must say, feel we must say. 6 months until you crawled, the only calm lay in your being tied to me, head up, bumping my ribs, head up, eyes open, that same position on my body that you took inside it, the acupuncture, the headstands, what I wouldn't do in those last weeks to turn you toward the earth. And everything slipping, permeable, you, me, the least of it, day, night, inside, outside, body, body, what I wouldn't do. I could open the door. Wait. Wavering Jewish atheist that I am, I made you.
So we know now that the poems in this book have to do with a new baby, presumably your baby. Over what period of time were these poems written?
Over quite a long time. I would say the first poem from this book that I wrote was written in around 2009 or 2010, probably 2009. And it was kind of a complete departure from what I had been doing before. And I hadn't written much for the previous few years because I had a new baby. And
that would take care of
and writing. A new baby who wasn't sleeping very much, and I wasn't very sleeping very much. And so there was a point where I was writing a very little bit, but it really wasn't going anywhere. And so after this first poem, they came kind of slowly but steadily until, I guess, the last poems in this book were written in mid-2014. So over a period of about 4 or 5 years.
Okay. Well, there's a poem in here I have to bring up to you. It's called Baby Honey, mm-hmm. Baby/Honey. And the title sounds like a term of affection. And it could even be a term between, you know, two teenagers or something, Baby Honey. But that notion falls away when you start reading it. And it is, again, the new mother who goes deeper into her fears in this poem, I think, of keeping the baby safe. Would you please read Baby Honey?
I will. And I just want to say about this poem that I think when you become a new parent, there's this weird thing that happens where you're suddenly in community with all these other mothers, all these other mm-hmm. parents. And you start realizing that there are shared experiences that no one talks about. And one of them is these kind of irrational fears. And we all have them. And, you know, and being able to say them is very difficult. And so this explores mm-hmm. that a little bit, not just my fears, but you know, the many kinds of fears that
but
one
thank goodness for that community, because you know you're not alone.
Yeah,
you know?
And I think, you know, having a small child is very isolating. So so this was is also kind of a love letter to the internet in its way.
Okay.
All right. Baby honey, do not feed to infants under 1 year of age. 1. It does help, the internet, the constellations of data, so much of it leaving one feeling even more so than before, alien, as in stranger on this planet. But still, but then, the echoing array of yes, me too, some days small bomb and others pure drug, sucked up in desperation and binge, endless catalogue of possibilities, scared to fall asleep in the rocker with the baby in her arms. Scared to walk by the upstairs railing because she feared tripping and tossing the baby over. Scared of measuring out the insulin incorrectly. Scared that she would walk out the door and down to the bar. And yet, and so, paralysis of possible fates. X carved into your ankle, antidote for snake bite. 2. Botulism? Really? Deliberate step past the top of the stairs. 3. That patch at the back of his ear, dirt and peanut butter and chlorine and milk. When it feels like too much, my friend says, I try to remember to look at their hands. Swarm circling the wild cherry in the yard, chopping apples for the new year. How we go about each day, how we ever get beyond that 1 square inch of skin. 4. Millions of babies, of mothers, millions more jars flowing from the conveyor belt. Labels in all caps, black on white on gold. Attention, mise en garde.
How long do these fears come up? I mean, how old is your son now?
Well, my son is 8, and obviously uh-huh. those fears change. You start worrying uh-huh. about their experience in the world. But uh-huh. I think there's apparently some hormonal something that actually, or there's uh-huh. some theory that there is an evolutionary advantage to these fears in the first uh-huh. year of a child's life. That it essentially allows, it puts parents on high alert for this new situation and mm-hmm. ensures our survival as humans or something like that. I read that somewhere. Anyway, mm-hmm. I would say that those kind of just, you know, crazy fears pass within the first year, but you're always afraid for your child and you're always excited for your child, and finding that balance in a way that's sane is always a challenge.
One of your poems, Chimera, seems to have come from an article in Scientific American. The epigraph, I think, came from mm-hmm. Scientific American. And it's micro-chimerism is a quote from that. I found it very, very interesting. And why don't you go ahead and read that, if you would. And if there's something you want to add to the term, please do.
Okay, well, I think the epigraph kind of tells you mm-hmm. what it is. It's a very interesting condition. Chimera. Microchimerism is the persistent presence of a few genetically distinct cells in an organism. Cells containing the male Y chromosome were found circulating in the blood of women after pregnancy. I want them out. I want to be myself, myself again. My old untethered, young untied. I lie. I want nothing more, or want no more the point. Dendritic, entwined, signed on for the duration, bright tangle, snaking line of fire. The crucible does not ask for want. Is. Tied in, shot through, fired.
You also find humor in, you know, in life. I found humor in some of your poems, and I really found myself laughing out loud after reading a line in the poem, after dropping my son off at preschool. And I want to say what the line is, but I don't want to ruin it for the people listening. I think they'll know what it is. So why don't you go ahead and read that poem, if you would?
I will. And I want to say something about humor is I like to think that I'm a funny person, but it never really came through in my poems before this book. And there's sort of just the ridiculousness of the situation of parenting, I think, necessitates that humor, that it's a saving grace. And so that I'm glad you found it funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
After dropping my son off at preschool, the world slowly coming back, the luxury of stepping outside myself. Where is outside, rehearsing for years now? I was a bubble, a greenhouse, a lens. Clear like water, present like water, spreading, reflecting, ratcheting down the viewfinder. Self being a place encompassing a small boy. Step outside yourself, ma'am, and no one will get hurt. Nobody got hurt, not seriously. It's a goddamn miracle. The world is mine for 6 hours. Newspapers. I could read a newspaper. I have the luxury, the privilege. I mention this only to get it out of the way. Pedicure, they say, money market account, Pilates, New York Times, Organic Tomatoes, LLC. Are you writing again? The ginkgo is dropping leaves on the sidewalk in front of the coffee shop. I want to have deep thoughts about this. The ginkgo is the most ancient of trees. I think I made that up. No, I Googled it. No... It is a luxury and a privilege to be such an idiot. Self being a place. The greenhouse encompassing three things, a mother, a ginkgo tree, a boy. He is always there. Now there are 7 or 8 toy vehicles there as well. He is framed with his father's help, the leaf of the ginkgo, full and red, 2 blushing lobes, and hung it on his wall at eye level. The leaves accumulate in my pockets, the glove compartment, along the back edge of my desk. Some of the leaves make it into collages. Some are given names. Henry, Alice, Bizzo, Mr. Zubs. Some are ground under the wheels of the cars, which also have names. Plotted and planned and tracked and graphed, and still it came suddenly, fogging the evil eye with its emerald swoon. The curving mire, the back-inness, rounded vowels through a scrim, a screen, seeped in that blood, recircled, recycled. No heaven, I thought, other than this, and, please God, just 10 minutes to pee. This is my job, and I am more than ready for it, and I am not ready for it, and what supplies have I packed for your journey? Water bottle, sunscreen, hats for sun and cold, snacks from the Japanese grocery, extra socks in a Ziploc bag. And oh, there is yet one part of me that breathes in and out at a quicker pace, that smaller, hotter heart. Drop off, pick up, the prescription, the renewal, the calls and clients, the days with their windows, rusty levers cranked open. I am back in the coffee shop 3 months later, 4, the ginkgo a pale green. I think this is where the metaphor breaks down. At night now, 2 stories, 3, I rub his back, inhale, a more complex loam. I step around toy cars, the animals arrayed in sentry against the dark. Open the door, close it quietly, and the night opens up its hours, a few more, a few more.
Lovely. Thank you so much. Tell me something about you. Where are you from?
Where am I from? I grew up in Stockton, California, in the Central Valley. Okay. And other than brief stops in back east for college and a year in New York and a little bit of time in Tahoe. I've lived in the Bay Area my whole adult life.
Yay.
Yes, yay. And you sort of find your place and you stick there. I remember being 7 years old and visiting San Francisco and saying, okay, I'm going to live there when I grow up.
Yeah. And now none of us can afford to live there.
Well, and now I live in Oakland with the rest of the writers.
That's right. Well, how did you find yourself writing poetry?
Like most writers, I'd always written. And again, I think seven is some instrumental age or something. That's when I knew I wanted to be a writer. I think I didn't know any writers, but I loved books. And I was kind of a lonely, shy kid. And I read a lot. I read all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think when you read enough, you start wanting to make books. And but I didn't take it seriously until my late 20s. I spent most of my 20s trying...
Oh, when you were so old. Until your late 20s.
Was that decade where, you see people come out of undergraduate or out of, even high school, they're very focused on being writers and on the professional aspects of it. And I just didn't have that confidence. And I wasn't writing very seriously. I write a few poems a year now and then, some stories. But the stories went nowhere because I'm completely plot impaired. So I had that thing where I realized I was a poet. I realized that doing what other people wanted me to do so they would leave me alone just wasn't working very well, and I might as well start writing and do what I wanted to do. And so I did. I took some classes with Kim Adnizio. I took some classes at UC Extension, where now I'm going to be teaching in the fall, which is really exciting.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah. And I wrote and...
And
here I am.
good. Well, the structure of your book is also interesting to me. And one of the things that is interesting is that you have two different poems with the same title, Anchor. Would you talk about those poems for a minute, and then why don't you go ahead and read them?
Okay. That was sort of strange. The image of the anchor kept coming up in my work, and they both seemed to need that title, and then I realized that the two poems were talking to each other, and I wasn't sure how to handle it. And I asked Ross, my editor, what should we do about this? Should we call them Anchor 1 and Anchor 2? He said, no, you call them both Anchor, and it's fine, okay. So it sort of created these strands between them that I didn't know were there when I wrote the poems. And I didn't write them, they were written maybe a year or two apart, I think our minds keep coming back to these sort of fundamental images. All right. Anchor. I believed I could make it up, that will was power, not in that greasy philosophy boy way, but in the ancient sense of generosity, of making a poem or a meal or perhaps a practice. I like that, just flexing the fingers. Why do I keep returning to that room, the scarred stone Buddha above the radiator, desk, and chair, mirror of tarnished gilt, and the rules did not apply? It helped that they were such small rules, art and finance and the hum of the freeway at the bottom of the hill, one window that opened. One thing can be made or kept for a while. If it wasn't something, it would be something else, a doubling of cells. Lucky, lucky, and eventually bad luck too. Category body, category money, category middle-class artists, global collapse, blow to the head, the tired usual, the high wire, and the blessed net. And lucky even out of that, wolf like a wind at the door. About that doubling, we made a person, anchored to the earth, lucky boy. So like I said, you do the one step, tra-la, see how it's done, and look up to find you are being pulled by something bigger, the hand of some giant clock, have in fact lashed yourself to it with great joy. And it split me open, made me pure triage. Will such a flimsy ticket. Mm-hmm. And here's the second anchor, which is the last poem in the book. Anchor. And if I put down my book to read him a book, and if I put down that book to check the mail, and if I put down the mail to get up and brush my hair and make pancakes because it is Saturday and I have promised pancakes, and if, in measuring the flour, I hold it up to the light to check the level, because I want to be more accurate, and if all this happens entirely in my head, because I am still, in actuality, trying to get myself out of bed, and, oh, I am so sick of the self. hauling it around everywhere, dragging it along even as my brain chases the tail of another dangling modifier in a sentence without a subject, that is, without an anchor, even as everything here is an anchor. The shell of the brush, the scarred griddle, my son's feet pushing into the warm space behind my knees, my husband's arm behind my head, tangled ballast, nudging our raft out into the day. I used to worry I'd float straight up off the earth, snap my tether, fear and relief. I was 20, it was all meaningful weather, flame and snow. Now the self is a turtle on a rope, prehistoric pull toy, heavy as a station wagon, with compartments for water and sunglasses. Sometimes I forget myself and leave it in the garage. Sometimes I ride it around so it doesn't get lonely. Sometimes it drifts off down a tributary and we go sailing on, three of us in our big bed. It thinks it's steering, but it's not.
Fantastic. Thanks. Well, we have some time left, and I'm mm-hmm. going to ask you just to read some poems that you would like to include in the program. Okay.
Great. Okay.
Well, go ahead and read, maybe two or three poems.
Okay, let's see. All right, this was the first poem I wrote in what eventually became the book. And after writing it, I had this idea that I was writing a book, which was really new for me. My first book was very much, I wrote a bunch of poems, and then it sort of became a book eventually, mm-hmm. after long struggle and many submissions. Mm-hmm. With this one, I really felt like I was writing towards something I could see. So this was... Flowers, doggies, the moon. It's only beginning to recede, that time, that milk dream of a year, the long hours in the rocker, the occasional calculating to assuage my restlessness, its portion, that is, the first of his, the last of my 30s, 1 year. 1%, too? Worth so much more, I think, once more, and so once more, keep rocking, switch sides, watch the last streetcars lumbering home through the half-open blinds, switch sides, brief flicker at the corner of his mouth, a sigh, rocking. And where else would I rather be? That's not to call up the rhetoric of choice, privilege, the drill of tussling generations, what we fought for, what we take for granted and embrace. It's just so difficult to step back into that sea, soft swirl without counting, only to rise days later at a different spot on the waves. What did you do today? Check the mommy memoirs. Nurse, bathe, dress, change, sleep, fail to sleep, feel about it, all the ways one is supposed or not supposed to feel. In the beginning, though, we were free even of the balm of naming. Flowers, doggies, the moon on its pages or in the sky. Only circles within circles and doing or even feeling so much beside the point, the warm thrum of the tide. Once I tried sitting, this when my life was one quietly perfectible room, discipline, books and tea, a long view of hills and the signal tower, driving to the Zendo in morning frost and folding my legs on a square white mat. How impossible it was, first sending each thought out on its little line, boat, boat, boat. Then the fidgeting, the sarcasm, sudden aches, then finally reduced to counting back from 100, and still the harbor with its jostling and its tethers, 38, 38, 38, 37. Isn't this one idea of heaven beyond giving or change or love and down into this deep, bright sphere of what is, tomorrow and yesterday lost in eddy of here? The only count, the heartbeat rhythm of his mouth, small round callus on the upper lip, and us together back and forth in the chair. How can you have memory without language? My friend asks, one of these many slow mornings, and even then the thought flows back into the sea, a place sans both 10 o'clock and tomorrow, present, present, present. Our two boys nursing again, sometime mid-afternoon, and a wave laps at the rug, each of us bobbing cross-legged and curled over, bowless holes for our swaddled sons. Is this why we remember nothing of the time? It's only position before. Memory without language, memory of face, smell, the bath, the big dog, the tree, but mostly of this. No name, no category, milk. the present nudging at the shore. He is asleep, and I am awake. My husband and I joke, what's a good dream for a baby? The breast. Bad dream. No breast. But seriously, folks, an eternity of no breast. 38, 38, 38, 37. And sometimes it is all I can do, calling up the masks of patience again. Nurse, bathe, dress, change, sleep, fail to sleep, feel about it. Walking, rocking, singing one song when all the rest have fled from memory. Oatmeal, oatmeal, it's a meal made of oats, made of oats, made of oats. Oatmeal, oatmeal. Repeat until the space between the blinds goes violet, white. Even out there, the lines get tangled, especially out there. Each hole throwing out a line to the next, a web, a path back to not here, not now, back on the shore of the phone call, the gas bill, the poem and how it should end, the need to show up tethered to the tug on the other end, and it's so easy to see myself hopping from one to the next, to link them like metaphor until all the clocks line up on either side and the kitchen and the desk are sparkling, empty, arrayed. Not now, not now, not now. Scows pulling out, laden. Rock, switch sides, watch for the slow dip of eyelid, the open hand. He's beginning to fight it, swimming up for one more round. Eye, eyebrow, nose, mouth, teeth, teeth of saying, and the moon on the waves is a moon in the book we read yesterday, in the big chair at the window, and the eye under its brow is round like the moon. The lines multiply, shimmer in the light of the day, of this morning and what we're doing tomorrow. And now we're again down in it, his eye a crescent slipping into line. And on the horizon, the dozen tiny holes receding, receding, going to silhouette as we're pulled together back into the mute night sea. All right, this is the last one I'll read. Charge. When the giant sacrifices himself for the boy, and on the screen the men marching toward him, all the pieces falling from his metal body, steaming in the snow. When the giant sacrifices himself for the boy at my side is lifted for a moment, filled with air, the intake, the stop gasp held aloft, no sound, the shock at the top of the arc, the drop, and only then, on the way down, opens into sob, hard water wrung from a knot, all the pieces falling. Small hot forehead pressed to my chest, animal exposed in the storm, knows himself then, knows himself to want more.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure listening to you and talking with you. Do you have an online presence that people should know about?
I do. LisaGluskinStoneStreet.com.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming up to Sonoma County.
Thank you, Kathleen. I really had fun.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you've been listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight, my guests were Mary Mackey, whose latest book is Travelers with No Ticket Home, and Lisa Gluskin Stonestreet, whom you just heard reading from her latest book, The Greenhouse. In between those two poets, you heard the beat poet Michael McClure with Ray Manzarek playing Spank Me with a Rose. For all live Word Temple Poetry Series events that take place at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, please check out wordtemple.com. I want to give a shout out to all of the poets in Sonoma County who submitted work to my Poet Laureate project, Digging Our Poetic Roots. There are many poems being put into a book right now, and an anthology will be published next year, and we'll start scheduling readings all around the county. So thanks to everyone who submitted poems. The anthology is going to be absolutely beautiful. And I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any questions or comments, please get in touch with me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.